This is the lecture for Biochem 421 for November
17, 2009. But there's no problem. This is November the 17th, a Tuesday. We're covering the last part of a chapter 15 handout that reviews glycogen metabolism regulation. Glycogen metabolism regulation. I'm on handout number 51, slide number 51. It's got a title of it called Glycogen Breakdown. Glycogen Breakdown. And this is a picture of the two regulation methods being used simultaneously to control an enzyme. Let me repeat that. This is an illustration, a nice graph. You don't find this in your own text. This is not in your text. They don't have it nearly as pretty or as effective as this one. And so that's why I chose this particular handout, this particular figure. This, again, demonstrates two forms of control for that particular enzyme. And that is allosteric control, which is based on the concentration of small molecules that temporarily bind to the enzyme and alter its behavior. And, yes, covalent modification in which a phosphate is added covalently to the enzyme, and that changes its behavior as well. Let's take a look at the enzyme details in terms of this regulation. I'll simply repeat what's listed there. Glycogen phosphorylase, there are two states. There's the tight state, or the B form, and the R state, which is also called the A form. And, of course, as we know, which of those two forms would be the active form, the T form or the R form? What do you think? R form. That is absolutely correct. All right. And let's take a look at what you see here. Notice, if you would, the diagram is divided. There's four different squares. There are two squares, upper squares, that have square corners, and two squares at the bottom that have rounded corners. The rounded corners indicate that's the active form of it. So the bottom two squares that have the rounded corners are the active, or R form, the relaxed form, as it were. And the top one, the top two, are inactive, as it were. And so you actually have four different species, or four different varieties of enzyme listed here. Hi.
Hello.
Nice meeting you here. Thank you for coming down front.
No problem.
Yes, since it's not so crowded, you can sit just about anywhere you want. It's like an airplane with not very many passengers on it. Yeah. Today is the day I should have had breakfast. What do you think, huh?
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would have just really irritated everybody really swell. Okay, let's take a look. You actually have, if we look in the upper left-hand corner, you have the T form, which is inactive, upper left. But notice the difference between the T form inactive and the T form inactive. The upper right and left forms is that the right form has been phosphorylated. And so you have, then, the inactive comes in two forms. It comes in inactive, not phosphorylated, and inactive, phosphorylated. Then you go down here to the bottom two, you have two active forms, one that's not phosphorylated and one that is phosphorylated. Let's see here. What I'd like for you to note is the width of the arrows. The width of the arrows indicate the predominant form. The width of the arrows indicate the predominant form, or the direction of the predominant form. Notice on the left two figures, left two squares, both the top and the bottom one, both the square cornered and the rounded corner, there is a arrow pointing upward toward the inactive form. That's the broadest arrow. You can imply, and not imply, you can state then that in this particular form, whenever the phosphorylase is not phosphated, the predominant form is the inactive form. Okay? So when the glycogen phosphorylase is not phosphated, the predominant form is inactive. Then if you go to the right-hand set of squares, the right-hand two set of squares, you'll notice the broad, wide arrow points toward what form? The T form or the R form? R form. Which means that in the phosphorylated form, the predominant form is the R form or the active form. So when it's phosphorylated, the phosphorylase is active. That's predominant form. When it is not phosphorylated, the predominant form is the inactive. Does that make sense? In other words, that if you take the inactive form, the T form, and you phosphorylate it with this phosphorylase kinase that's listed there, as soon as it becomes phosphorylated, you know, it shifts its equilibrium toward the R form. But there's always a small pool of phosphorylated inactive, okay? Which is another truism. In other words, that all four of these forms probably exist at any one time in the cell. Now, they don't all exist in the same proportion. Obviously, anytime it's phosphorylated, there's going to be predominance of the active form, the phosphorylase A form in the rounded corners is going to be going to be predominant. And anytime you have a predominant non-phosphorylated form, the inactive form is going to be predominant. But there are other times in which this becomes active or inactive based on cellular conditions, not on a covalent purpose, not on a covalent action, but a non-covalent action, an allosteric action. So let's take a look. Let's say, for example, you had a pool of glycogen phosphorylase in which the predominant form, all four forms, was the phosphorylated active or R form phosphorylase A. So out of 100 molecules, let's say 60 were in the phosphorylase A form. Okay, that's the active form. If in that same cell, however, you began to build up glucose, notice that glucose right there that joins with the smaller arrow. If you began to have high levels of glucose, which way would the equilibrium shift between that phosphorylase A active and inactive, that is from the bottom to the top? Would it go from the bottom to the top or the top to the bottom? It would shift toward what? The top. In other words, that despite the fact you have the phosphorylated glycogen phosphorylase, which is active, you have a large pool here of active, high levels of glucose in the cell will force, through allosteric action, that phosphorylase AR form to take the T form and become inactive. So you have both enzymatic covalent control, and then you have a metabolizing allosteric control that will dictate the exact proportion of turned on phosphorylase and turned off phosphorylase. Is there another way we can look at this? Is there other factors? Yes, absolutely. Let's say that you had another cellular status in which the most of the pool was in the non-phosphorylated inactive form, or T form, and the next largest form was the R form that is the phosphorylase B in the R form. We can shift the relative proportion of the non-phosphorylated glycogen phosphorylase. Boy, was that a mouthful or what? Did that make any sense? What? Sure. We can shift the relative proportion of the non-phosphorylated phosphorylase B by altering these metabolism components, AMP, ATP, and or G6P. Let's say, for example, you had a large proportion of the two boxes that do not have a phosphate on them. And the cell began to build up high levels of AMP. What's going to happen to this inactive pool between T-form inactive and R-form active in the two non-phosphated groups? What's going to happen to that if we suddenly start having high levels of AMP? What's going to shift? You're going to move some of the molecules from being inactive to what? Active. Because of high levels of what? AMP. Okay. Whether or not it's phosphorylated. But notice the AMP acts on the non-phosphorylated form. Glucose acts on the what? Phosphorylated form. Right. Okay, and then you've got the ATP. You have a pool here. High levels of ATP or G6P, which indicates a good energy status, a high energy status in the cell, shifts the pool of the non-phosphorylated active form into the non-phosphorylated inactive form. So the tendency is with high levels of ATP and G6P to move the active to the inactive. That's what this broad arrow means. Okay? So we're looking now, let's just quickly review. We're looking at two kinds of regulation of this enzyme. The covalent modification form and the allosteric form of method, I should say. The covalent modification method for regulating a protein or an enzyme and the allosteric method of regulating a protein or enzyme. And you can see here that if I have an inactive form and I phosphorylate it, the tendency is for the phosphorylated form to be what? Active. Thank you for the shout out. Okay. Which means that the non-phosphorylated form has a tendency to be what? Inactive. Okay. But can you take the phosphated form and make it inactive? Can I take the phosphated form and make it inactive? Say yes. High levels of what will cause it to become inactive? High levels of what? Shout it out nice and loud. One more time.
Glucose
will take that active form and make it inactive. Which one of these is that? Is glucose, would that be allosteric or covalent?
Allosteric.
Thank you very much. All right. Now, what will shift the phosphorylase active form to the inactive form if it's not phosphated? High levels of and or will shift it toward the inactive form. That makes metabolic sense. What will shift this unphosphorylated T form to the active form? AMP. So, the phosphorylation is one level of regulation, and the glucose and ATP, AMP, G6P is another form. The glucose, AMP, G6P, ATP, that's allosteric. The phosphorylase kinase is covalent. Now, notice, obviously, if you have a kinase, which adds a phosphate covalently, you need another enzyme that does what? Dephosphorylates it. But they don't call it a dephosphorylation enzyme. They call it a phosphatase, and it's a general one. It's called a phosphoprotein phosphatase. Okay? So, you need to be able to explain this diagram pretty well to me. Now, why am I asking you to discipline yourself to be able to explain this one to me? Because it has elements that you will be able to apply to virtually all control of enzymes from now on. You get it in your mind how the allosteric control and the covalent control coordinate in this model, And it becomes simpler to understand how it occurs in virtually every other model in the body. So I want you to take this very seriously. Okay. High values of AMP shift T to R through allosteric effector sites. High values of ATP shift R to T through allosteric effector sites. Phosphate group attached to serine protein causes T to R shift. It's active when phosphorylated, and that's the enzyme. This is what you're getting, glycogen and glycogen minus 1 plus GTP. This glycogen debranching enzyme, we didn't talk about the regulation of it. And phosphoglucomutase is, in fact, reversible. It's right at equilibrium, so this simply depends on which has got the higher concentration. If there's lots of G1P relative to G6P, the forward reaction is favored. If there's lots of G6P relative to G1P, the reverse reaction is favored. It's all based on mass action quantities and concentrations. Now, I want you to look at this phosphorylase kinase. One of the questions that you should have is, well, is that phosphorylase kinase always turned on? Is this phosphoprotein phosphatase always turned on? Well, if both of them are always turned on, aren't you going to kind of have a kind of futile cycle? You use up an ATP to phosphate it and turns around and removes that phosphate? Exactly right. If you've got an enzyme controlling an enzyme, guess what? There's an enzyme controlling that enzyme. And guess what? There's an enzyme controlling that enzyme. There are layers upon layers upon layers upon layers of control in your cells. I don't care how simple other scientists may claim, or archaic, or ancient. Every cell, in order to be able to adapt, has layers upon layers upon layers of interrelated regulation. And as we look at cancer and so on, mechanisms of cancer, we're discovering that very complicated pathways intersect with other very complicated pathways. And the information that we're getting from our experiments is so complicated, we're having difficulty interpreting the data. Don't be discouraged. We'll figure it out. Probably not in my lifetime, but we'll figure it out. There is a cure for cancer. Well, except for the fact that because cancer is specific for the cell type and the tissue and the method of initiation of the cancer, the physicians have designated probably between 300 to 400 specific types of cancer. Each of those types of cancer has a specific cause. So when you talk about finding a cure for cancer, You are asking the impossible. There is no one cure for cancer because cancer is 300-400 actual different diseases. So they can cure one, that same process may not cure another. All right. Heterotrimeric G proteins. You may have seen this. I've asked you to memorize it. Let's go through and figure out what exactly this is. One of the most important and potent signaling molecules in the body is a molecule called cyclic AMP. This thing right here, CAMP. That cyclic AMP is known as a second messenger. If it's a second messenger, what's the first message? The first message is typically the external signal, either a stimulatory external signal or an inhibitory external signal. There is a receptor that penetrates from the cytosol through to the surface of the cell that has a receptor site waiting for a signal. Within the cytoplasm of the cell, if you're dealing with heterotrimeric G proteins or just simply G proteins, this signal, this receptor, pardon me, has a cluster of three proteins physically next to the receptor on the interior of the cell. It's called an alpha, a beta, and a gamma. Now, so if you don't see the alpha in there, do you see an alpha in there? Put an alpha. And actually, if you can put an alpha S, that would be swell. an alpha S. So alpha S, put that right here. Over here on this side, put an alpha I for an inhibitor. That would be great. Now, in its unresponding mode, when it's not responding to a signal, there's nothing bound on the surface, and the G proteins are clustered together as a trimer, and there is a GDP attached to the alpha subunit. Let me repeat that again. In the inactive form, in the non-signaling form, there is no ligand on the receptor, and the receptor and G proteins are closely associated with the G protein trimer being physically close to each other, attached perhaps, not covalently, and there is a site on the alpha subunit that has a GDP molecule sitting in it. That's the resting state. If a signal, for example, an external signal comes along and lands on that receptor, and it could be one of dozens and dozens of signals, and that receptor takes that, absorbs and attaches that, there's a covalent, a conformational change in that receptor, and the G protein trimer responds as following. Two things it primarily does. First thing it does is it releases the GDP and attaches a GTP to it. A GTP. GTP. Right. T as in TED. GTEDP. And when it does that, the trimers separate into a dimer of gamma and beta and a lone sigma form, or alpha form, alpha. That alpha form, alpha subunit, is turned on. It becomes active when it is separate from its other two subunits and when it has GTEDP attached to it. So at this point then, in this model, the GTP then associates with AC, adenylate cyclase, an enzyme that's on the interior of the cell, and that adenylate cyclase is then activated or turned on even more, and 4-ATP then are acted upon by the cyclic AMP, or actually ATP is acted on by the AC, and it makes cyclic AMP, which is the second messenger. Is the second messenger. Cyclic AMP. C-AMP. So adenylate cyclase has its function of taking ATP and making it cyclic AMP. All right, let's review this again, shall we? Let's review this again. A receptor, a ligand, lands on the receptor. The inactive G proteins then do two things. They physically separate, and the GDP is released, and a GTP is added at that same location. The active alpha subunit that contains the GTP then goes on to associate with adenylate cyclase to stimulate its production of cyclic AMP. Thus, cyclic AMP levels in that cell go up. Everybody got that so far? Okay, now then. If the body has a mechanism to turn something on, it must have a mechanism to do what? Turn it off. Now, how do you turn this off? What's not shown here is the site where the GTP binds is actually a GTPase. So point an arrow at where the GTP is and say, GTPase. So as the GTP binds to that alpha subunit, there is a low level of activity of a GTPase that converts that GTP spontaneously into a GDP. You see the two arrows that are shown? See that curved arrow that passes through that GTP? I think there's something missing there. But anyway, see this? And it's got the GTP right there. Okay. What I want you to put here is water here and PI here. Okay. And if this gets hydrolyzed from GTP to GDP, what do you think happens to that alpha subunit? Does it remain activated or does it become inactive? Inactive. That's exactly correct. So what turns off the alpha subunit? It does. It has a timer on it, as it were. It's like you leave a room inactive and in a few minutes the lights just automatically go off because there's some sort of timer. That GTPase activity is a timer, as it were. And as soon as that hydrolyzes that one phosphate off the GTP to make it GDP, this process is reversible and the two subunits and the alpha subunit recombine to form the trimer. If they reassociate with the ligand and there's no, if they associate with the receptor and there's no ligand on it, then they go back to being quiet and inactive. If there continues to be if there is a ligand on the receptor, then the whole process starts all over again. And so you have a continuous loop, as it were, of GTP, GDP, GTP, GDP, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So that's how G proteins work in a simplified context. What happens, however, what is that second messenger doing? Well, that second messenger, actually, that 4-cyclic AMP begins to interact with an enzyme called R2C2. It's designated that. You can also call it, and write this down if you don't mind, underneath there. Are you ready? Cyclic AMP, right, CAMP-dependent protein kinase. CAMP-dependent protein kinase, also known as protein kinase A, which is abbreviated as PKA. Actually, it's a lowercase k. PKA, same enzyme. PKA. So cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase and protein kinase A is the same thing. You'll see it both in the literature. What does this thing do? The cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase actually has 4 subunits. There are 2 catalytic subunits and 2 regulatory subunits. The regulatory subunits bind the cyclic AMP. The catalytic units are the kinase part of that name. The regulatory subunits each bind two AMPs, cyclic AMPs. When they bind those cyclic AMPs, the catalytic subunits are freed from their physical association. And when they become free from their physical association, they begin to act like the kinases that they are. And they begin to take proteins and phosphorylate them. Now that phosphorylation can either be turning them on, as in glycogen phosphorylase, or turning them off, as in other enzymes. So you get this cellular response, some sort of cellular response. Now again, the body has a means of making cyclic AMP, which is a second messenger, and signals the body to do other things. Of course, if the body has something, if it turns it on, it's got to figure out to do what? Turn it off. And there is an enzyme called phosphodiesterase, which acts on cyclic AMP and breaks the cyclic bond simply to make it 4-AMP, and that turns off the second messenger. Turns off the second messenger. Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things here is that phosphodiesterase is actually inhibited by a small molecule you might be familiar with. Caffeine and theobromine, all right, inhibit the phosphodiesterase. Now, why would that be a stimulatory effect, do you think? It temporarily increases the levels of what in the cell? Cyclic AMP, which is a stimulant, typically. It heightens the metabolic activity of the cell no matter what. Okay, now, a couple of other things that are interesting. You can have this same process in which an alpha subunit actually inhibits a cyclic AMP. So you can have competing signals occurring simultaneously in which the alpha subunit is attacking or attaching to the cyclic AMP, adenylate cyclase primarily, and then modifying its overall level in the cell. So it's a very complicated integrative approach to metabolism that you've got here if you have both of the signals that are being attached at once. If you have an inhibitory signal, this alpha subunit will stop or slow the production of adenylate cyclase. Notice what cholera toxin does. Cholera toxin blocks the phosphatase. The cholera toxin blocks the phosphatase, which means that the alpha subunit is always turned on. That's what cholera does. And then finally, you can have this pertussis. One of the effects of the pertussis is to block the activation of that subunit. In other words, that it blocks the exchange of the GTP with the GDP and keeps it in the inactive form. That's one of the also other things that it does. The pertussis, cholera. At any rate, so a wide variety of things that are going on here. Now, all this is integrated, as it were, in the following diagram. Whoops, well, here's another one. Cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, also known as PKA. Two regulatory subunits bind cyclic AMP, releasing the catalytic units. The catalytic subunits are enzymatically active as monomers. All right, glycogen phosphorylase bicyclic cascade, ladies and gentlemen. Now, you've had to memorize this, is that correct? Yes. Now you're going to understand it. All right. Now, the neat thing about this is going on right now in your body, primarily in your liver. Have you breakfast yet? Yes. What did you have? You had a bagel. Outstanding food for breakfast. Primarily because it has a significant amount of carbohydrate, and they are a rapid food source. Absolutely, rapid energy source. Excellent. But it also means that the body's having to go, man alive. All right, so the brain needs glucose. The blood is saying, this is before breakfast, the blood is going, I ain't got no more glucose to give you, brain. And, the pancreas is going, what to do? Let's see here. Should I release more glucagon or insulin? What does my gut tell me? Did you have any food in your gut about 6 o'clock this morning? Or when did you have your bagel? Just now? Okay. 6 o'clock in the morning, did she have any food in her gut? And so her gut was telling the blood, ain't got squat. Ain't got nothing. And the blood's going, hey. And the pancreas is going, what? Oh, man. I need to shift my hormone balance. And it shifts from being high insulin to glucagon ratio to a low insulin to glucagon ratio. Glucagon gets dumped into the blood. And the liver's going, hey, there's glucagon in the blood. That means the blood needs sugar. So we better start breaking down what carbohydrate we have in the liver. Let's see here. How do I store carbohydrate in the liver? In what form? Glycogen, right? And what enzyme breaks down glycogen? Oh, yes. The confidence with which that was said was just overwhelming. I'm just so pleased. The enzyme that breaks down glycogen fundamentally is, of course, glycogen what? Phosphorylase. I wish it was called glycogen breakdown enzyme. But it's not. It's called glycogen. And what's the enzyme that makes it? Glycogen synthase. Right. All right. Well, The glucagon lands on a receptor in the liver cell. And that receptor turns out to be a G protein trimer dependent. So that G protein trimer then separates that GTP alpha subunit that attacks the what? Adenylate cyclase and makes lots of what? Cyclic AMP. All right. So here we go. Glucagon has landed on the surface of your liver cells, signaling for G proteins to make high levels of adenylate cyclase. And we see high levels of adenylate cyclase right there. I mean, adenylate cyclase, turn that on, and we make high levels of cyclic AMP. What does that cyclic AMP do? Well, here you've got that R2C2 protein kinase, or cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, also known as PKA. It's in its inactive form. How do you know it's in its inactive form? Because it's a tetramer with the two regulatory sites bound to the two what? Catalytic sites. When the cyclic AMP level rises high enough, the regulatory sites release and we get two catalytic sites, the two catalytic subunits. Protein kinase A. Now notice it says active right here. Is that correct? All right. So protein kinase A is now active. Or cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase is now active. A kinase does what? Adds phosphate to stuff. That's correct. Let me pause here and let's take a look at the diagram and what kinds of enzymes we actually have listed here. We've got a glycogen. Right in the middle of the enzyme is actually the actual focus of all this cascade. The middle of this diagram actually has two enzymes shown here, in either an active pool or an inactive pool. The first enzyme on the left here in the middle is called glycogen phosphorylase. If you notice, it has two forms. One is called B and is not phosphorylated. The other is called A and is phosphorylated. From our previous discussion, can you tell me which one is the active form? The glycogen phosphorylase B or the glycogen phosphorylase A? A is the active form. So glycogen phosphorylase A, when it's phosphated, is active. That's the predominant active form. See, A, either phosphorylated or not phosphorylated, it's always active. Okay, so So when it's not phosphorylated, it's inactive. When it is phosphorylated, it's active. There is another enzyme here. Set of enzymes, one more enzyme, a pool of two forms. This one is called glycogen synthase. Guess what it makes? Glycogen. So on the same line right here, we have a pool of enzyme that breaks down glycogen. We have a pool enzyme that does what? Makes it, synthesizes it. Now, if the body is not completely insane, in the same cell, would you want both of these activities to be turned on simultaneously? Both the breakdown and the synthesis. Would you want that both turned on at the same time? No. It would make sense metabolically to have a set of circumstances that would allow one type of activity to be turned down or off while the other activity is turned on or up. Make sense? Let's see if the body can do that. Follow the bouncing phosphates. All right. The protein kinase is active. There is an enzyme called phosphorylase kinase. Ooh, phosphorylase kinase. Where did we see phosphorylase kinase before? Let me see. Oh, right there. Phosphorylase kinase. You mean to tell me it exists in two pools? Yes. There's a pool that has not phosphorylation, and it's the B form, an inactive, and there's a pool that's phosphorylated, and it's the active form. So the protein kinase A acts on the phosphorylase kinase, makes it phosphorylated. The phosphorylase kinase, since it's now active, begins to act on the phosphorylase B to make it active to the phosphorylase A, and it turns on the breakdown of glucose. So, before she ate breakfast, the predominant activity was glycogen phosphorylase here, because she needed glucose in her blood. Notice, if you would, by phosphorylating, by adding a phosphate to the phosphorylase, I've turned on the enzyme. Please note with me the following interesting idea. That same protein kinase will come over here and attack the active glycogen synthase, which is active in its not phosphorylated form. And by phosphorylating the synthase, it shifts from being active to what? Inactive. So the same kinase, which turns on, basically phosphorylase, turns off the synthase. Does that make sense? At least on the first go-around it does. Yeah, exactly. All right. So, now the interesting thing about that phosphorylase kinase is it's got 16 different subunits. It's got 4A, 4-alpha, 4-beta, 4-gamma, 4-delta, and it can have multiple phosphorylations. It can have up to 8 phosphorylations. And it's like a little rheostat or variable resistor. The more phosphorylates it has, the more it's phosphorylated, the higher its activity. So 2 phosphorylations turns it on to some degree. 4 would be great. 6 would be great. Even better. And 8 would be maximally turned on. All right. So I said, just to repeat, the cyclic AMP high levels dissociate the protein kinase A. The catalytic units then come down and phosphorylate the kinase to make it active, and the kinase then phosphorylates the phosphorylase to make it active. That same kinase will come over here and phosphate the synthase and make it inactive. So the same action that turns on the breakdown turns off the synthesis. It's a fabulous system. I wish I'd thought of it myself. But of course, I didn't. I didn't design it. Someone else did. Now, well, this is a complicated thing, Dr. Novak. Yes, it is. But if you put the effort into it to really understand it, it's going to make everything else when you talk about enzyme cascade control easier. Now, we've got a problem here. The body's got a problem. Those phosphates right there that turn on the phosphorylase and turn off the synthase, they're covalently bound. This is not an allosteric regulation that we're showing right here. Well, if you had an enzyme to put it on, you're going to have a what? Enzyme to take it off. Well, how do you turn it off? Where is that? That's right here in the dephosphorylation system that you see at the bottom. Let's take a look at its components. It seems unnecessarily complicated, but welcome to life. Now, if a kinase puts on a phosphate, what takes off a phosphate? A what? Phosphatase. And there's this phosphoprotein phosphatase in its active form, and it'll take off that phosphate of the synthase and make it active, and take off the phosphate of the phosphorylase and make it inactive. Where have we seen phosphoprotein phosphatase before? Oh, right there. Phosphoprotein phosphatase. We've seen it before. What a delight. Nice to meet you again. Well, how do we turn that on? Do we always want it on? No, we don't always want it on. We want to be able to turn it off. We don't want it cleaving off those phosphates as soon as they're made. So how do we turn it off? How do we regulate the regulator? There is, not surprisingly, an inhibitor. Another protein that when it binds with the phosphatase makes an inactive dimer. So notice here, if you would, the phosphoprotein phosphatase inhibitor, when it's active, binds with a phosphatase and makes an inactive dimer and basically removes or reduces the amount of phosphate that's available or phosphatase that's available to do the phosphatase activity. Well, how do we make that? How do we regulate the inhibitor? Is the inhibitor always on? No, the inhibitor is not always on. How do we turn on the inhibitor? Well, follow the bouncing protein kinase A. So, protein kinase A is active. It comes down here and begins to act on the inhibitor, in which there are two pools of that inhibitor. There's a small number that's inactive and a small number that's active. By having this protein kinase A active, it comes on and shifts the equilibrium to where there's now a predominant amount of phosphoprotein phosphatase inhibitor. It does that by adding a phosphate. So when the inhibitor is phosphated, it will bind to the phosphatase and make an inactive dimer. Voila! And therefore that reduces the amount of phosphatase activity. Let's try this again. I've got a couple more minutes. So, protein kinase A is turned on. It phosphatates the kinase, making it active. That kinase acts on the phosphorylase to make it active, and you start dumping glucose into the blood. That same kinase, protein kinase A, comes over to the glycogen synthase, phosphorylates it, and turns it off. That same kinase goes down and begins to act at the bottom of the figure on the phosphoprotein phosphatase inhibitor, shifting its equilibrium toward the active inhibitor. The active inhibitor then binds in equilibrium with the protein phosphoprotein phosphatase to make an inactive dimer. And therefore, the same activity that turns on the kinases turns off the phosphatases. Cool. Outstanding. Don't mean to get you... I don't mean to be... You know, the excitement I know is almost more than we can bear. But it's been a long morning, and I've been yelling at you all morning. All right. Now, another question for you, ladies and gentlemen. Notice the inhibitor is phosphated covalently. How do you turn off the off switch? If this is an off switch, which it is... And we turn on the off switch. Boy, that's an odd way of putting it, isn't it? Turn on the off switch by putting a phosphate on there. How in the world do I turn off the off switch? What? You got to take the phosphate off. Well, in a illustration of how the cell is controlled chaos. And there's seldom, if any, absolutes involved with cellular metabolism. Notice I've been always talking about the fact that we're talking about equilibriums. That this inhibitor, when it's phosphorylated, shifts the equilibrium to the inactive dimer. That does not mean that every phosphatase has been consumed. There's always a low level of phosphatase available. The body never gets rid of all the phosphatase. So what happens is the phosphatase comes back and actually begins to interact with the phosphoprotein phosphatase inhibitor and deactivates itself. The phosphatase turns off its own off switch. The phosphatase turns off its own off switch at a constant low level. Okay? At a constant low level, and thus you have this dynamic situation where there's a constant equilibrium shifting between inactive dimer, active monomer, and the inactive dimer being hydrolyzed to the inhibitor, phosphorylated inhibitor, being inactivated by the loss of the phosphate by the thing it's actually inhibiting. Okay? So, do you understand how then this, and guess what? This is an easily understood cascade. You should wait until you get in some of the development ones. Can someone tell me basically what walking is? Walking. Have you ever started to go walk and then get your foot trapped? And what do you actually start doing? That's a stupid thing. Stupid idea. Here, let me just tell you. Walking is controlled falling. Is that correct? If you begin to walk and you don't put your next foot down, what happens? You fall. In a generalized form, life is exactly like that at the cellular level. It's an inequilibrium condition that constantly has to be regulated. It has to constantly be caught, constantly, where these interactions are constantly altered. Minute by minute, the relationship between the phosphorylation system and the dephosphorylation system is in a state of flux, depending on the circumstance of the cell, the tissues, and the body. All right, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you tomorrow.